Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Eleanor Hall. This Tuesday, Australia's Race Discrimination Commissioner fights moves to change the role's title. And a dramatic reduction in the number of students taking up economics has the Reserve Bank worried. We hear from some of the school students who love the subject.
There's definitely a lot of content which is challenging, but a lot of the skills we're learning, the analytical skills, these are tools I'm going to use in whatever career I choose to do in the future.
With economics, you get like a broader view. I wanted to study economics so I get a whole idea of what's going on in the world. I'm not oblivious to these sort of things.
But we begin today in Singapore with the high-stakes meeting that has the world on edge. As we go to air, US President Donald Trump and North Korean Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un are meeting one-on-one in a luxury resort on the island of Sentosa. This first ever meeting between a US president and a North Korean leader comes only months after these two were trading personal insults and threatening nuclear war. Fast forward, and the pair are expected to be discussing North Korea's denuclearisation in exchange for relief from sanctions. Not an easy negotiation. President Trump, though, seemed optimistic heading into the meeting.
I feel really great. We're going to have a great discussion, and I think tremendous success. We'll be tremendously successful. And it's my honour, and we will have a terrific relationship, I have no doubt.
And Kim Jong-un is also talking up the chances of a successful summit.
The past worked as fetters on our limbs, and the old prejudices and practices worked as obstacles on our way forward, but we overcame all of them, and we are here today.
That's true.
In a moment, we'll hear from an Asia analyst who is more cautious about this meeting. But let's go now to our chief foreign correspondent, Phil Williams, who's in Singapore. Phil, are you picking up any signs yet on how that meeting is going? There was, of course, that comment from President Trump that he would know if it would work within the first minute. I presume we'd know if he stormed out?
Well, no, he hasn't stormed out. And so far, so good. They've had the one-on-one meeting with just their interpreters. He's described that as very, very good. That they have an excellent relationship, that they will solve the big problems that they've been unable to solve so far. And he said they will be successful. It will be done. Now, what it is remains to be seen. What sort of trade has been done or is about to be done? They are now sitting down with their various delegations, the president with his inner circle on his side and Kim Jong-un on the other side of the table. There have been exchanges of handshakes. The atmospherics seem pretty positive after a fairly grim start with the opening handshake. But so far, so good. But it really, all of this is doesn't matter. It's the result that matters and the result that can actually be verified and holds up, not just tomorrow or next week, but in the coming years.
And what indications are the advisers accompanying both these leaders giving about what will be included in any deal?
Well, we haven't really been given much at all, but Mike Pompeo, who the Secretary of State, US Secretary of State, said before the meeting that the US was going to put something on the table they've never put on the table before, but he wouldn't say what that was. But he also said that they will not take the foot off the throat on sanctions until the nuclear weapons are verifiably removed from North Korea. Now, that could be a very, very long process. That could take years. In fact, there are many analysts who cynically say this is just a ploy for time from the North and that they'll try and basically outlive the presidency of Donald Trump. But look, there's a lot of cynicism about this, understandably, because the North have basically dudded previous American presidents one after the other. And there is, amongst some people, a very strong feeling that here we go again. However, maybe, just maybe, Donald Trump is about to do something that no other US president could do, pull something out of the hat, and we could have a more peaceful peninsula. But there's a very strong caveat on that, and it's fueled by history.
And as you say, there's a lot of fear about what these two may agree to, and there's a suggestion that if the US were to agree to a deal that put the US out of danger of nuclear attack, it would leave US allies like Japan and South Korea at risk. In the last day, though, the president has had phone calls with the leaders of both countries. What can you tell us?
That's right. We don't really know the substance of those phone calls, but from the Japanese and the South Korean leaders, they're obviously deeply concerned that the president consider their interests above all. And after all, particularly for the South Koreans and of course, the Japanese, they're the ones that will live with the consequences if this goes horribly wrong. They're the ones that would die in the hundreds of thousands if it turned into a nuclear war. Perhaps millions could die. So the stakes are extremely high for them. What they don't want is the Americans to cut a deal, for example, where the North Koreans say, OK, we'll cut our long-range ballistic missiles, the ones that can reach the United States, but we'll keep the ones that can hit next door, the South Koreans and the Japanese. That's unlikely to happen. However, many in South Korea are concerned that what they might do is come up with a deal where the American troops, and there are 30,000 of them in South Korea, are pulled out, or at least partially pulled out. And many South Koreans regard those troops as their security blanket, and they don't want the Americans to go. They don't even want them to reduce those troops even by a few thousand. So very, very high stakes at the moment. And the substance of what has been agreed or what is being agreed right now, we simply don't know.
Phil Williams, our chief correspondent there in Singapore, thank you. Well, watching all this closely from the other side of the world is Dr. Sheila Smith, an Asia specialist at the Council on Foreign Relations. She joined me from Washington. Dr. Smith, welcome back to the world today.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
So the two leaders are meeting alone this lunchtime. What are the risks and the benefits of a meeting with just these two and their translators?
It's obviously clear that President Trump prefers the personal relationship. Kim Jong-un is not a leader who's been out and about in international society, in diplomacy very often. And so it might be useful for the two leaders to have a little bit of alone time, sort of gauge each other, but also to establish a bit of rapport. The risks, of course, are that whatever it is that's ahead of us on the Korean Peninsula, whatever this initial meeting is going to produce, there's a lot of heavy lifting to be had. So there's a lot of concern and angst about what Donald Trump might say in the meeting and what might be promised or implied that might, you know, put at risk some of these larger issues about the long-term security of Northeast Asia.
How much trust do you think there's likely to be on either side?
I don't think we should expect much trust. Honestly, I think the if you look just at the interests of the United States and the interests of the DPRK as expressed, we don't have similar interests at stake here. I think both countries want peace on the peninsula, but we want it on different terms. And that's the real crux of this first meeting is, do we recognize that the DPRK wants legitimacy, wants nuclear weapons to make sure that its regime continues to survive? Do we recognize that they're really going to put all that on the table? And I think that that's where the weak spot is. I think when many of us look at President Trump, we're not quite sure what he's ready to bargain away.
The US is still calling for complete denuclearization, but even if he wanted to go down this path, presumably there would be constraints on President Kim from his own military.
You know, we know so little about the inner workings of the government of the DPRK. Kim Jong-un and his father before him have encouraged the military to create the kind of capability that we're now trying to negotiate away. So there will have to be some really strong incentives for Kim Jong-un to go back. Now, we can say it's economic incentives, but that's not enough, I think. We have to understand from him very clearly what it is that he is willing to barter with, what it is he wants in order for him to get to where we want him to be, which is this complete, irreversible, verifiable denuclearization. And that's the question mark for me. We don't know yet really what Kim Jong-un is really willing to do.
Is it possible that we could see a partial denuclearization deal done which protects the US from long-range nuclear missiles but does leave Japan and South Korea vulnerable to attack?
There you have the conundrum for our allies. And I think there's been a lot of signals that the Trump administration may be willing to do that. And it may be that Kim Jong-un is coming into this conversation with the president thinking he can separate the United States from its allies. And that, I hope, the president is not going to allow him to do. I think what we must see, or we must recognize that we are going to see, is a phased process. No matter how serious he is about denuclearization. None of this happens overnight.
China's leaders are also obviously watching this very closely. How much influence will they have in any final deal?
They will have a lot of influence. The Chinese have all the levers on the economic side. We don't have any. We could create some in the form of a carrot, investment, trade, other kinds of things. But on the ground, we don't have any trade with North Korea. The Japanese cut off their trade more than a decade ago. And the South Koreans, President Moon Jae-in has closed the industrial park that had once been one of the pieces of the economic interconnectedness between the North and South. So China's got a lot of leverage.
Just a final question, Dr. Smith. We had a former Obama Deputy Secretary of State for the region on our program yesterday, and he said that if this meeting fails, then Donald Trump may well abandon diplomacy of any kind for a military solution. Is that a concern that you share?
That's something that I worry about. Well, we're looking at this summit as if it's the opening in a positive, constructive process. But high-level summits also fail. If this fails, there's so much at stake here for South Korea, for Japan, for China, for the United States, and obviously for North Korea, that a slight mishandling of the personal dynamics, pushing the envelope a little bit on the drama, could really leave us off kilter and make everybody step back to the heightened military tension that we saw all the way through the end of last year. There's all kinds of reasons to be worried about the fragility of this meeting.
That's Dr. Sheila Smith, an Asia specialist at the Council on Foreign Relations. Now to some extraordinary developments in the scandal over child sexual abuse in Chile. The Pope has accepted the resignation of three of the South American country's bishops, but they're among 34 who've offered their resignation, and it's unclear how many more Pope Francis will accept. The Vatican says it's the first step toward reordering the battered Roman Catholic Church in Chile, as Catherine Gregory reports.
Chile's Catholic hierarchy is undergoing a huge transformation in the wake of a child sexual abuse scandal. Three bishops are already gone after Pope Francis accepted their resignations.
We can't rule out there could be new measures from the Pope himself. What he has highlighted in this letter to the people of God is that measures in itself from the Vatican are insufficient to be rid of the culture of abuse.
That's the General Secretary of the Chilean Catholic Church, Jaime Corro. He believes that more bishops could be replaced, since a total of 34 have offered up their resignations to the Pope.
That we break away from that culture of elitism, from that culture of collaboration in crime, so we are able to offer guarantees that children and youngsters who are in the church are being cared for and treated with respect.
The scandal revolves around Father Fernando Caradima, who was found guilty by the Vatican of abusing boys in Santiago in the 1970s and 1980s. And one of the bishops to go, Juan Barros of Osorno, is accused of having witnessed the abuse and not doing anything to stop it. Pope Francis had previously stood by Barros, a move which later forced the pontiff to make a public apology. That was because a sexual abuse investigator produced a 2,000-page report which accused Chile's bishops of grave negligence in protecting children and found that evidence of sex crimes had been destroyed. Chileans have hailed the bishop's removal. One of them is Teodoro Quitanon.
I think the Pope is acting the way Chileans wanted, as people from the south wanted him to act. I'm from the south. I lived for many years in Osorno, where Bishop Juan Barros was located. And I think the Pope, based on what he is doing, is proving the people of Osorno right.
Other Chileans want him to face persecution by the judiciary. This is Claudio Quilecho.
For once and for all, there should be justice for all these people, because it was not just them who were affected, but the conscience of all humanity.
But Chilean lawyer Juan Francisco Arriagada is more neutral.
I don't want to be an executioner at this time, but I feel this has been building up for a long time and it has been hidden in the church.
A Vatican committee has been set up to fight sexual abuse and help victims.
Catherine Gregory reporting. This is The World Today, and if you miss a program, you can find us on the ABC Listen app or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow us on Facebook and on Twitter at ABC News, and you can contact me at Eleanor Hall 1. The Race Discrimination Commissioner has launched a strident defence of his position and, in particular, its title. Dr. Tim Soutphommasane is speaking here to reporter Melissa Clark.
We need to ensure that we have a strong stance against racism. It has always been called the Race Discrimination Commissioner since the Australian Human Rights Commission has been in existence. It wouldn't be good enough if we were to go softly in our combating of racial discrimination. Racial discrimination should not be something that remains an evil that shall not be named. Fighting racism is hard work at the best of times. We've simply got little chance of fighting racism if we can't even name it.
The Attorney General, Christian Porter, has suggested that community relations could come across as more conciliatory. Is there not merit in that argument?
Well, the job of fighting racism should be one that is taken up directly. We've got a lot of threats to our racial harmony at the moment. We know that extremist nationalism is on the march. What we can't do is send a signal that we are going more softly in countering racism. Of course, community harmony is part of the job when it comes to anti-racism, but to change the title of an office such as this, which has existed for many decades, risks sending a dangerous signal to the community that our public stance on racism is going to be softened.
Is the debate over the naming of the office that you currently hold connected to the 18C debate, or are these separate issues?
A debate about the title of Race Discrimination Commissioner could just be another way for certain elements in the government to revisit the issue of Section 18C of the Act, because you can't just go about changing the title of this office. The terms and the functions of the office, including the name, are set by legislation. So if there's a serious desire to change the title of Race Discrimination Commissioner, that can only be done if you change the Racial Discrimination Act. And doing that can open up another debate yet again about the Racial Discrimination Act and challenge its integrity. Those who want to revisit the Act should know that the multicultural mainstream of Australian society will not stand for any weakening of our laws or our public stance against racial discrimination.
If I can just pick up on something that you'll be mentioning in your speech today, you're saying that Chinese Australians are apprehensive about some of the focus on the Australia-China relationship at the moment, particularly with quite a fevered debate about espionage and political interference, and that could result in blowback on Chinese Australians. What could or should national leaders be doing to ensure that doesn't happen?
We've got to make sure that we have a proportionate response to foreign interference. As a liberal democracy, we've got to take seriously anything which undermines the integrity of our institutions, including our democracy. But what we've got to avoid doing is we've got to avoid having any sentiment that's directed at the Chinese Party State or the Chinese Communist Party spill into general suspicion directed towards Australians who have Chinese heritage. What we should not be doing is creating an environment where Chinese Australians may need to work two times or three times as hard as anyone else before they can be accepted as loyal citizens of this country.
And that's the Race Discrimination Commissioner, Dr. Tim Soutphommasane, speaking to political reporter Melissa Clark. The Brisbane City Council wants to reduce the speeds of mobility scooters and is also asking the state government to consider a basic licence for the use of the scooters. But the Pedestrian Council of Australia says a speed limit is not enough. In Brisbane, Rachel Mealy reports.
Anne is the mother of two sons with muscular dystrophy. She and Matthew and Adam were out and about this morning at Brisbane's South Bank. Anne doesn't agree with the proposal for a speed limit reduction.
Well, for these boys, I think it's ridiculous because, as you saw when we were walking, I don't have any problems keeping up with them at their 10. If they lowered it to 6, they wouldn't be able to keep up with me.
Harold Scrooby is the chairman of the Pedestrian Council of Australia. He says allowing mobility scooters on footpaths presents too many risks.
When if you look at the footpath, this is the first time since Roman times that we've started to allow vehicles on them. And their primary use is for walking. And when you consider that we've got a rapidly ageing population and that the highest cause of avoidable death after you're 50 is from a fall, we've got to start to ask questions as to whether we should be allowing vehicles on footpaths.
Mr. Scrooby says a national approach to the issue is needed.
We are a rapidly ageing population. there are going to be a lot more people using these devices, which is a good thing. We want to keep the community mobile, but we also want to keep all other road and footpath users safe.
Queensland's Police Commissioner Ian Stewart says it's an issue that needs further consideration.
My dad used to have one, and he used to travel like a kilometre and a half down to his local shops, and he'd do that at the speed limit. But of course, in the shopping centre area, much slower. And I think that's part of the answer.
Daniel Lloyd is a paraplegic who's been using a mobility scooter for the past 3 years. He says life for people like him is hard enough.
Look, I think it's hard enough getting around as it is. I mean, if that's the case, I'd go back to a manual wheelchair, which I can do 15 or 20 kilometres an hour in. You know, so if they're going to slow you down that much, it'll actually make it more dangerous because people will change and do something different. But it's hard enough to get around anyway without discriminating.
The use of mobility scooters is currently part of a federal parliamentary investigation which was triggered by an accident involving the wife of National Party Senator John Williams.
Rachel Mealy there. It's not often that the Reserve Bank Board takes issue with what's happening inside our classrooms. But the central bank is now warning about a drop in the number of students taking up economics at high school and at university. It says this is leading to a lack of diversity in the field and could have long-term implications for the nation, as Antoinette Collins reports.
So wage outcomes has been low and it has been a concern to the government.
This Year 11 class at Sydney's Riverside Girls High School might not sound all that unusual.
Still, we need to be generating stronger wage growth.
But it is, because they're studying economics, a subject that's in decline, especially among girls.
With economics, you get like a broader view compared to business. I wanted to study economics so I get a whole idea of what's going on in the world. I'm not oblivious to these sort of things.
In the last 5 years, enrolment in economics at the school has been hovering at an average of 4%. For a couple of those years, there was too little interest to even offer the course at all. Teacher Lisa Edwards says many students are opting for business studies instead.
Business studies is really easy to sell. It's all about how to run a business. Economics is harder to define. Like, it's really hard to say to girls that this is going to enable you to explain and debate the world that we live in.
It's an issue that's causing concern for the people who steer the Australian economy, so much so that the Reserve Bank's Head of Information Department, Jackie Dwyer, spoke to The World Today in a rare media interview.
Ultimately, economics has an image problem. It's losing the race to its rival subjects, and that goes to too few people really knowing what it is, how it might be relevant to them, and how employable economic skills are.
Over the past 25 years, there's been a steep and dramatic slide in Year 12 economics enrolments, falling by around 70% across the nation and as much as 75% in New South Wales. The introduction of business studies in the early 90s is seen as a major cause. And where economics is concerned, the gender imbalance is also more pronounced than in STEM subjects, with roughly twice as many male students as female students. The disparity continues at university, where those students completing an economics degree are more likely to be men from higher socioeconomic backgrounds.
They'll typically come from a nice postcode. So that's actually an important point because we're seeing a significant fall in both the size and diversity of the student population.
The New South Wales Education Standards Authority is currently reviewing the Year 9 and 10 Commerce course to strengthen economics content. It's also consulting on a review to the syllabus to reflect the post-GFC world and changes in the national and international financial landscape. Teacher Lisa Edwards says the curriculum needs to be refreshed. It hasn't been updated since 2003.
We could be looking at, you know, what Trump's doing and how he's made a change within his economy and the reasons for that. The global financial crisis was 10 years ago now. These girls are now too young to even remember that. And that's what economics needs. It needs something to draw them in.
Making more profit because of productivity increases, yeah, they can afford to pay.
Back in the classroom, 16-year-old Emma Van Tommen has her sights set on pursuing economics.
There is definitely a lot of content, which is challenging, but a lot of the skills we're learning, the analytical skills, these are tools I'm going to use in whatever career I choose to do in the future.
Good on her. Economics student Emma Van Tommen ending that report by Antoinette Collins. And that's all from the World Today team for this Tuesday. Linda Mottram and the PM team will be along this evening and we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. I'm Eleanor Hall. Have a lovely afternoon.